So yeah, we make our small talk. Then we go live with the Sportscar Safari podcast. Welcome, everybody. We're here on another Thursday. Co-editor Andrew Coles dialing in from Cambridge in the UK. Luke Jaxer, Adelaide, South Australia. And joining us, very honoured to have Ryan Koenig calling in from Sydney. Ryan, how are you going?
Very well, very well. Fun and games.
Thank you for joining us. So, for those that don't know, we're going to delve into this. Ryan is one of the probably, I guess, most well known as one of the most experienced sort of Porsche people, for want of a better term, in Australia. But a very very wide ranging automotive experience and tastes and very wide. So I think it's going to be an interesting chat. So yeah,
and,
Luke
and how... SCS feature story.
Yes.
Person issue... as well. Issue two
with the yeah.
That was so a fun day. That was a very fun day. I remember that day very well. It was good watching you drive my slightly random creation back to the shed. That was fun.
That was
Centerfold issue two.
So Ryan's how we met Ryan. Ryan has what was affectionately dubbed as the Rally Cab, which is a beautiful SC 911 convertible, wide body with the beautiful orange, yellow and red stripes, raised off road tires, spotlights, and we took it out on a very memorable day out of Sydney and did some lairising around in the dust. That was a very good day. There was Luke's just sharing, for those on audio only, Luke sharing a picture of it on three wheels, tripoding, going across a slightly four-wheel drive track. Ryan, well, I guess we're on the subject. How did the Rally Cab come about?
I've been messing about with mainly early 911s for a long, long time. So we were just talking off air. I didn't come from a car family or anything like that, and without getting out the violins, was a broke country kid, so I didn't have a car at university or anything like that. So I got a job. I was an engineer for a short period of time, and I went out and I bought this really awful Datsun 1600, but it had twin Webers, and the guy opened the bonnet and I was just a wood duck. I mean, I just bought this stupid thing. And I had that for a little while, and then I started reading car magazines and sort of getting, I'd always been interested in cars and mechanical engineering. That was what I was doing as a profession. Got sort of a bit deeper into things, and I started thinking, okay, I'm going to get something. The data was pretty bad. It was fun. It got me around for a while, but it was pretty toasted. And I started looking at sort of the world of classic cars, and I zoomed into BMW 2002, Alpha 105, and at that point they were very hard to find in Oz, and there seemed to be full concourse restoration cars, absolute crap cans, and almost nothing in between. And so I decided, perhaps for, be a bit safer, I'll go and buy something a bit more modern. So I went looking for a Peugeot 205 GTI, and they were quite a contemporary car. So we're talking early 90s. And they were out of reach of the budget, and that led me to the fantastic Suzuki Swift GTI Gen 1, which was my first real car, 9,000 RPM. It said in the manual that they could do 178, which they do in true Japanese efficiency. And I had that for a while. And then there used to be a very well-known classic car dealership in North Sydney called the Toy Shop.
I remember them big part through of the articles and stuff. Yeah,
big part of the Sydney scene for a long, long time. Yeah. And I went past there one day and they had an early 911, I can't remember the exact year, 71, 72, bright orange. And I was like, wow, look at that. And what really caught my eye was it was advertised for a fraction of what they are now, like it was 28 grand or 30 grand or something. And then it had the lease number next to it. And at that point, I'd transitioned out of being an engineer, and I was on my way to sort of retraining in the legal area as a what's called a patent attorney. And I was chatting, and I had one really good mentor in the firm who was the car nut. He's got an E-type and a Dino and a few other cool things. And I was chatting to him, and he said, "Oh, well, look, you know, the bank's probably not going to want to let you lease a 30-year-old car, but, you know, let's go and ask." And they did. they put me on this bizarre deal where I think I had like some huge residual or something. That became my daily driver, this orange. So I went and test drove that car, and the test drive was pretty terrible. I remember the gear shift knob came off in my hand. but I also, and I truly remember this to this day, North Sydney is a series of basically 90-degree corners everywhere. And I went up the hill out of the dealership, and I turned the wheel to go around this 90-degree corner, and I just literally had this sensation of, this is how cars are meant to turn. I mean, 911s, early 911s have this famously delicate communicative steering that everyone raves out about in every review you've ever read, but it's true. And this was not a good example of the breed by any shape or form, but it steered like no other car I'd ever driven. And I was hooked. So I found one, incidentally, I found another orange, a 1970 911E. A few months later, I ended up buying that, had that for a while. It had various, it wasn't great. It had various death rattles. And I then ended up joining the Porsche Club and got interested in doing sort of super sprints and track stuff. And I thought, this thing has so many death rattles, it's going to blow itself to bits. So I ended up selling it, and it resurfaced about a decade later, and a very good friend of mine in Melbourne now owns it. And the original motor with its original death rattles is sitting under his shed, and he had a hot rod 2.7 sort of RS motor stuck in the back of it, and the thing's a weapon. Yeah. So I went and bought what they call a G50 3.2 Carrera, because they were known to be the most reliable, robust, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Started doing club sprints and stuff like that. And a little bit further down the track, really sort of the bug was really biting on the competition side. And so I went looking for what used to be known as like a club car, like a car that had, you know, it wasn't a race car, it wasn't logbooked for anything, but was set up for track events. So I bought this car, which I still own today. I've had it for 20 something years, and I've got a few cars that I just have as absolute keepers, that we affectionately call the War Horse. I've done everything in this car.
Is that the blue one? The blue with the yellow bumper?
It's been rebuilt numerous times.
Yeah.
So it used to be a very generic 2.7 RS replica with a little motor with Webers on the back. And we built it up and we did all the safety gear, and I used to do club stuff in it. And then decided to go tarmac rallying. And tarmac rallying is really like getting into an arms race. So you do your first tarmac rally and you tell yourself that I just want to have fun. I just want to finish and not roll the car up into a ball of steel. And then you find yourself 5 years later with something like that, which by that point was mostly fiberglass, had like what they call a 2.8 litre RSR plus motor that we built, a special gearbox that we built with incredibly low gears, big brakes. I found a little wrinkle in the rule that I don't think a lot of other people had seen. And STs weren't really known. STs are very well known now. Everyone knows what 911 ST is. When we built that car, they were still, there wasn't a lot of data out about them, and they had some funny kind of things. So with tarmac rallying, a lot of your capacities and things had to be based on a multiple of what people ran back in the day. Found a particular car that ran back in the day that wasn't very well known, based my car on that. So we used to run in what's called category four. So it used to be between sort of early classic and late classic. And so we got to run in early classic, but we had like, I don't know, 100 cc's more capacity than everyone else. And yeah, the thing was great. I did Tiger Tasmania three times, got our gold plates on our first kind of three goes.
That's an achievement.
Yeah, it was. So, yeah. I think we ran top 20 or something by the end. We ran it in Adelaide with you guys, ran Classic Adelaide many, many, many times.
Well, the picture Luke's got up on the screen at the moment for those watching video is the Mount Lofty jump, the famous sort of summit road jump, and there's a wee bit of air under the wheels there. And yeah, it's funny. I definitely remember the first time I sort of discovered your Instagram a few years ago. I was like, oh, who is this guy? And then you look and I found those classic Adelaide pictures and I was like, oh, I know that car. And yeah, very regular competitor.
Actually, I think I've got a photo of that car from when I was, you know, film camera, young teenage boy trying to take pictures of.
Yeah, cool. I mean, we got that into top five at Adelaide.
Especially back then. That competition was fierce back in those days in the classics. Yeah. That's a good achievement. Yeah.
And then that car, we rallied it for a bit, and then we had one reasonable incident which saw us leave the course. We weren't hurt, the car wasn't really that hurt, but it was a bit of a wake-up call. But then tarmac rallying, it was really becoming an arms race. Everything was getting really, really, really fast. By this point the open cars were running 3.5, 3.6, 3.8 litre motors. People had discovered piranhas. So, you know,
explain a piranha to people who don't know what they are, because they're crazy.
some nutbags in South Africa built a version of a tiny little V6 Capri with a Windsor V8 in the front of it. And so those things were genuinely turning up with 600 horsepower and, you know, 7-inch wheels. They were,
crazy.
It became pretty binary. If you wanted to win those rallies, you needed an RSR. Like a big capacity RSR or a Piranha.
Because at that time you had Kevin Weeks, who was at the sort of height of his competition. I mean, he had what was effectively a V8 supercar team and a full workshop down there. And didn't they develop a custom fuel injection system for that 911 with slide throttles and all this crazy stuff on it? Like, that was a very serious car.
I remember the last rally we did. I by that point I'd been around these cars for a long, long time, and his sounded like nothing else in the paddock. I mean, to this day, I don't know what the capacity really was. It sounded like a bloody truck.
I can't imagine he would have been willingly stripping down his engine to prove capacity.
One of our common friends wants to hear more about obscure steering wheel choices.
We'll get to that, Felix.
We'll definitely get to that.
but then it all sort of took a bit of a sour turn. We missed a year because my navigator couldn't come, and some guys we knew had a double fatality in an RSR. We went from having a core group of 20 or 30 teams that were all used to just have a ball on tour, and it just wasn't, there was just no one left. Everyone just left. But then I kept the car. I did some circuit racing in it. It wasn't really its forte. That's running it at Bathurst. Running it at Bathurst was a hoot. I mean, running it at Bathurst. I decided to sort of park it, and I used to just use it a bits and pieces. And a lot of the people I knew that had been in tarmac rallying all sort of slowly, one by one, drifted into Group S historic racing, which has a much what you're allowed to do in Group S is very, very, very restricted compared to what you can get away with in a tarmac rally build. And went looking for a car, did this bizarre swap deal that made no sense, and ended up with a little 2-litre 911, which is the Bahama yellow car.
Beautiful.
Which is a cracker. It's a delightful little thing.
Here somewhere.
So that's sort of how that car kind of came about. And the current plan for the blue car is, I mean, I've been talking about this forever and I don't know when I'll get around to it, but it was originally Conda Green, which is quite a rad color. And I've got vague designs on take half the roll cage out, put some comfy chairs in it and paint it Conda Green. But I don't know. I've got another mate who would just kill me if I did that, because we did all this rallying together, and he's like, "Well, the blue car is just the blue car. Just always been the blue car."
Yeah.
The car was originally Conda Green. That's a pretty bright green.
Yeah.
I actually reckon I have behind me here
a Conda Green.
I reckon that's Conda Green.
Conda Green, Conda Nice. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
That was my grandparents gave that to me at German church Christmas one year when I think I
was
10 years old or something.
Because most of the bright green early 911s you see getting around are Viper, which is ostensibly a safety color. Condas are a little bit different, but whereas the Bahama car was silver when I got it. And
the Bahamas. Yeah.
It's now back into its original color.
Oh, really?
So it was delivered in Bahama. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, great. Yeah, yeah.
And it's tricky, these things. I mean, the problem with a lot of this at the moment is, you know, without straying too quickly into the topic of value, you know, that's removing cars from racetracks at a rate of knots. And it's understandable. I mean, people say, well, I was prepared to punt a car worth X around the racetrack. It's now worth 4X or 3X or 2X or 6X. So I'm now not.
Yeah. And then it becomes a question of what you're willing to risk. And it's the same, you know, you look over here in Europe and you see, you know, the Sports Purpose and the Tahoe guys have got the 2 liter cup and the racing is amazing. But yeah, you look at the values of those early sort of pre-66, pre-67 2 liter cars that they're racing, and it's just mind-boggling what they're turning, you know, that the cars that they're turning into those racing cars are just incredibly valuable before they even start sort of bashing.
Yeah, but you don't see it a little bit in the States, but in Europe, the cars, my view is that the cars are now becoming the entry tickets. So you started seeing it over the last, say, 5 to 10 years. Eligible for Mille Miglia, ran at Goodwood last year. And those 2 liter races, you know, for a while there, so long as it was short wheelbase, no one cared.
Yeah.
Suddenly, I think it's the Peter Auto group who run one of those 2 liter cups. I think they're now just saying, no, if it's not a 65, well, it's not you can't come.
Yeah.
I had someone explain it to me. I went to Goodwood with a great friend, Alex Webster, a couple of years back, who races at that time. We were racing matching 2 liter cars against each other. He's now gone up to a big boy 2.7. And they were saying, well, in their kind of Intermark series, if the guy next to you is sitting in a real Cobra, he doesn't want you in a converted 912 mock-up.
No.
He wants you to have skin in the game.
Yeah.
But that, I don't think that works here because we don't have the volume of cars.
No. No. So going back, you touched on it earlier, because I think a lot of people who haven't been fortunate enough to sort of drive and spend time with 911s, and particularly early 911s, there's a lot of hype. And I think especially in the age of Instagram, and that it's almost reached saturation, you've got, you know, all of this stuff. And I think a lot of people are a bit fatigued and a lot of people just kind of don't get it. And I know, you know, myself, I sort of have been, I have nothing the scale of you, but I've, you know, kind of spent a bit of time in a 72 Oil Clapper, your 2.7 and then a 964 RS. And I just remember the first time I kind of drove them, you spend a couple hundred miles and then the penny dropped and you go, oh yeah, I get it now. Like, you know, the steering, just the way the door closes, to just all those little things. And it's like, suddenly it all just makes sense. Like I understand it's not all hype. Like, this is real. Can you sort of tell us what your take on that is and how you feel?
I think that's right. I think, and I mean, it's also, I mean, one thing you're seeing in a lot of the, lot of the press at the moment is, you know, they're not having a value increase. They've just been undervalued for a long period of time. I don't know where that sits, but they are pretty unique in the world of classic cars. They're incredibly well built. They're robust. They're really simple. They don't have any water in them, which, I mean, if you can have a car that doesn't have water or a coolant system in it, that's a win for a start.
For an old car, yeah, especially.
It simplifies the car. I mean, Jim Richards famously, you know, the first time he did Targa Taz, he had a leftover GTR. He turns up in his GTR. They're rebuilding it literally every night, and he's watching all the Porsche guys go blip, blip, and go and have, you know, wash their car and go and have dinner. So he turns up the next year in a brand new off the shelf, at that point, not really highly modified. You know, it was a current model 993 turbo, big car.
Mm.
And the rest is history, the most successful tarmac rally of all time in his 60s. And I think that's one thing that attracted me from the sort of engineering side of things, is that if you prep these cars properly, they are super, super robust. Don't get me wrong, you can break them. I've done it. It sucks. and when you do, it's pretty ordinary. But they've got a great size. The packaging in them is good. It's funny, there's all this stuff at the moment, you know, the new Gordon Murray supercar and the T50. And I've watched a couple of the sort of explanations and stuff. And so much of the commentary is about packaging and size, you know, and he's managed to somehow, in a world of 2-ton mega horsepower cars, build a sub 1,000-kilogram car that meets all the current rules. It's astounding without turbochargers.
I mean, I just love.
I mean, that car is the last hurrah of supercars.
Yeah. Maybe so the Aston Valkyrie, but yeah.
I mean, and it's funny, you see it in. I had a really funny experience. There's a lovely fellow. He's a surgeon that races Group S in a TR3A. And when it is running, it is properly fast. I mean, it's terrifying. Your arms hang out the doors and all that kind of stuff. But we were sharing a garage at Eastern Creek one weekend at a race meeting. And it got to just near Sunday lunch, and I was reading a newspaper in a chair. And he's just been up to his elbows in his motor since Thursday, and told me that he'd done something like, let alone races, he'd done single digit laps in the last three race meetings he'd been to. He'd been having a really bad run.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, have you opened your sort of, have you done anything to the car? And I said, no. And he said, are you going to check the oil even? And I said, well, no, there's a gauge on the dash, and you know, it's, we prepped the car. And he stood there, and he got sort of more and more, not cross, agitated. Yeah, that was a reasonable proposition in a historic race car scenario, and that was and that's what you used to see at tarmac rallying. When we really had the car developed, and look, it did take a lot of preparation, but when we had it developed and humming, you know, the last few Classic Adelaides or something we did, it was tire pressures, and wash the thing. You know, they are incredibly robust, and as road cars, you get the same thing. Like they don't get me wrong, they have faults, and they've every generation of 911 has quite inherent design faults in them. You know, there is stuff, whether it's some of them have shit valve seals, some of them have bad head studs, some of them rust.
They've got RS bearings.
Wrong bearings, you know.
Wrong bearings.
But that stuff can be sort of ironed out pretty well. And you've got they're sort of relatively, I think in that context, they're robust. And you don't need to spring them particularly hard. Like, I don't think, you know, you don't need to, you know, my personal view is that they're nicer on skinnier tires. They steer nicer. They don't need a lot of rubber. And a lot of that is weight, like that little Bahama car in the corner there, you know, that's got a very, very, very big roll cage in it. You're not allowed to use fiberglass in Group S, so it's still everything. I think the bumper bars are fiberglass because we kind of lobbied that, you know, all the British guys could just take theirs off and leave them home, so that wasn't fair. But that's a sub-1,000 kilogram car.
With a big cage in it.
With a big cage in it, like a really big cage in it.
Now, when you say that, we're talking about the T50, and then you think that that's a sub-1,000 car with a V12 in it too, that's when my mind blows.
Like, yeah. That thing is insane. Yeah.
Because it's funny. It's funny you say about the 911s, because I certainly found, you know, like, and Luke and, you know, our background is Italian cars, and don't get me wrong, I think, you know, when an Italian car sparkles, and I guess we can get onto this later, but when an Italian car is in the right, you know, when the stars align, there's nothing like it. Like, it's amazing. But when I spent some time with this 72, it just worked in every scenario. Like, if I was going out for a bit of a, you know, country road, bit of a blast, it was great and it was sporty. It was relaxed for cruising. I had to drive it down into London, and it was I could just traffic. It was fine. My fiance Chantel, she's notoriously very critical on a lot of the cars I like, and she's very harsh. And she agreed. She's like, no, that's a cool car. And most of the stuff I think is cool, she's like, it's a bit midlife crisis-y, you know. But she looked at that and was like, that's cool, and she loved it. And I thought, this is the only car I can think of that ticked. Like, I just want that. That's all I want. Just that 72.
And so when we started this to loop back to sort of how Rallycab came into existence, then suddenly they became very valuable. So that just changed everything. It took a lot of the fun out of it. A lot of the race cars started appearing. The concept of a club car that you put a seat in and, you know, do some stupid shit on, you know, that sort of disappeared. I kind of felt that some of the fun was coming out it a bit, and started, you know, I still have sort of a bit of a strong custom theme. So I built some other cars in the meantime. I think the purple car, that was just a labor of love. I found that car, it'd have every 80s crime committed against it you could possibly imagine. You know, a G series turbo bodied yellow thing. I've got a thing about yellow cars, which people that know me know. But
like, a bad people, thing, people, obviously.
Sorry?
A bad thing about yellow cars.
A very bad thing.
Yeah. Is that like my grandfather that would never have a green car because he crashed his Mini?
No, my nightmare is that, you know, I come across the best barn find in the world, and, you know, the guy opens the door and pulls the dust cover off, and there's like a pristine 27 RS or a 959 or something, and it's yellow, and I just have to shut the door and leave it and go away. But so this car is an Australian delivered, right hand drive early 911 Targas are very rare. They only made them for 1 year. They made them in 73.
Yeah, wow.
Before that, you couldn't get them in right hand drive. So they're 1 year only. There's not very many around. Like, so this one was terrible when I got it. Original drivetrain was long gone. It had a fuel injected 3.2 out of a Carrera. Perfect. I actually had a really nice Targa at the time that I brought in. I imported from the Channel Islands of all places that I sold, because it was a minter, and I wanted to do something sort of custom. But even then, so I'm starting with this absolute crap can of a car, and I'm getting heat when I say I'm going to paint it purple. They're like, well, surely you've got to paint its original delivery color. And I'm like, there's nothing original left. You know, and the only defense I had was that is a 73 color. That is royal purple. You could have picked it. Almost no one did. I like orange and I like purple. I've always wanted to do a purple car. And I thought, if I'm going to do this, and this car needed everything, you know, we had to rebody almost the entire thing. It's still got the original doors, but that's kind of it. I had a lot of the bits because my rally car is mostly fiberglass now, so all the steel bits kind of came onto this. And I was quite happy. You know, 3.2s are a very easy motor to live with. they make lots of power. They've got a computer, so they always start, you know, they don't misbehave. It's got a Rorty exhaust system that came in from the UK. It's got a really, 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 really good suspension setup from a mob called Elephant Racing in the States. On the softer side, so they do this kind of 0 to 5, and your brain goes, awesome, I'm going to chuck the 5 in.
5.
yeah, give me the hardest.
You know, we did this car on a 2, and it's wonderful. It's very fast. It's very easy to drive fast. Beautiful. But, you know, but people that don't know you will tell you that you've painted your own car the wrong color. And I just said, this is just getting out of control. Like, it's...
That must be such a peach.
And I wanted to sort of push this vein, mine this vein a bit further and do something stupid. But then you get the, you know, you don't just want to rip up money for the sake of giving people giggles. I'm not a YouTuber. I'm not a, you know, you know.
Get the clickbait.
And yeah. So I was looking around and I'd started seeing the safari cars were starting to appear in the States, particularly. Started looking around at stuff like that. But then you go looking for a half-decent air-cooled 911 coupe in Australia, and they were just, you know, they'd all just gone gangbusters in price. And I kind of, so I looked at sort of other platforms.
What year was this? What year were we talking about here?
2 years ago, a couple of years ago.
Right. So it's basically peak air cooled.
Peak air cooled type.
Peak air cooled.
And I just couldn't do it. I thought it just didn't make any sense. And then I kind of thought, well, what's another way of doing the platform? And I'd seen a couple of Targas. They didn't work. I'd just finished building a Targa. I didn't want to do another one. And then I looked at 914s. I looked at 944s and other sort of things in the market. And I just kind of thought, I was looking at a convertible one day, and I actually found a guy that does renders through Insta. And I said, look, just indulge me here. Render up this cab. Here's some ideas. And it came back and I thought, well, that's just awesome. Yeah. and so the cab that I bought, which was in beautiful condition, was literally half the price of a coupe. Yeah. And I just kind of thought, and it gets back to this, I mean, we sort of talked about Zollhaus a bit and the plans for that, but that's about the kind of applying as much design as you can up front before you break out the stuff. So I'd done sort of almost a design study in architecture sense. And it's like, well, how many of these other styling cues can I bring into this car so that people will basically, so the fact it's a cabriolet should become irrelevant. It should just stand on its own 2 feet. Like everyone still thought it was nuts, but everyone kind of liked it. And what was really interesting is it far exceeded my expectations. I mean, you've driven it, on how nice it was to drive.
It was so good. It was to me, I feel that when people build safari coupes, there's this expectation that, oh, it's a rally car, you should be able to go and do the, I don't know, the Fink Desert Race in it, or there's some sort of seriousness about it. But being the cabriolet, it was like, no, this is just a car to enjoy the beach. Like, it's just a really fun, and it was really good.
You talk to Californians and they're like, oh, you know, you go out in the desert. And I'm like, you don't go out in the desert in Australia. You go to Australia and you die. And we don't really have, you know, you see where those Lee Keen cars are located. And it's basically split between people that live next to deserts or people that live in the Pacific Northwest where they've got forest trails.
Where do you use that in Australia? Like,
So in respect of its suspension setup, it was pretty mild, and it just borrowed, you know, there's just some neat little tricks. So the guy that set it up for me has done all my suspension stuff for decades, a fellow called Dave Folsom of East Coast Suspension down south. And he's a really interesting guy because he's set up race cars for years and years and years. and bash cars for years and years and years. Yeah. And so I just basically gave
knows all about Kingswoods then.
And he said, what are we doing? And I just said, look, get it as high as you possibly can for the looks, but it's still got a steer. And he made some spaces up. So he spaced all the front of it up under the strut. So all the geometry stayed the same. The back, we just wound up. We put big, tall, skinny tires on it. But I mean, everyone drove it and everyone just thought it was hilarious. Although those tires, when you let the car sit, went square as hell. And so it would thump down the road for about 30 minutes, then they'd get warm, then it would all kind of smooth out.
They're still noisy tires. Like they're not.
They are very noisy tires. But it was just sort of picking up all those kind of, and when you get into the original Dakar cars, the big four brace spotlights. There's these, the bash bars. Rear lights, mud flaps. You can sort of borrow all this kind of imagery. But it was just a hoot of a project. And so that was really, is there an appetite, particularly in Australia, which is pretty conservative, for, some more interesting custom style 911s. It was a lot of fun. The only part of that project I didn't really get to do in terms of the sort of test bed element of it, I never really got to advertise it publicly and see what the response was to it that way, because I sort of texted a couple of people and said, look, this is going to hit the market soon. Do you know anyone that is mad enough to like it? And I think the second guy I texted basically just bought it.
Well, great, but also,
And it was really born out of the frustration of this stuff is all getting a bit serious. And there was, I was noticing, like, there's one of the main sort of popular Porsche forums in Australia, has this dominant what's for sale thread. And it is so much of the traffic on that particular site.
Yeah.
And it's a bit sort of, I don't know, it's just a bit, just take some of the fun out of it when you do like a cars and coffee or something, and all people want to talk about is the dollars and cents behind these cars.
And also there's the values, but I find in the modern stuff, and don't get me wrong, like the whole movement around PTS and, you've got your Instagram page and that, it's like, great. I love PTS. I think it's awesome. I think people having GT3s in unique colors, great. But then when people don't drive the cars and they spend hours in car parks just wanking over the fact that, oh, you've got this particular stitching on your seat and you've got this, and then they ignore the fact that they own one of the best driver's cars in the world and they're not driving it. Like, it's like, what's going on? Like, yeah, sure, have a Miami Blue RS, but go and do 9 track days in it. Like, it's that, that to me is just missing the point of the whole cars as well. Like, it's, yeah.
Yeah, and the early cars, the early cars in particular had, they went from being really sort of quite a little niche area to just an explosion in people looking for them, and it just kind of changed things.
The thing I do like, though, some ways for the better,
some ways for the worse.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the ways for the better is definitely example of your Targa is coming back to what the car was more original, rather than all of these horrid C2 conversions and all of that kind of stuff. Mm. But those cars actually coming back to originality a bit more, I think.
Well, it was funny. That was painted by some good friends of mine, John and George Segul, so Zags Auto, quite well known body shop in Sydney, and they're at full circle now. So they're getting cars back that they converted forward, coming back to them again to be converted
to be reconverted back
the way they were. Yeah. And in some cases, people have turned up with a G Series car that was made to look like a 964. They're bringing it back. And now they want it backdated to look like an F-Series car. Like that. And they're going to go, well, this guy's probably going to come back in another 10 years.
10 years.
And we'll put it back to the middle again. Or
That's an interesting one, the G-Series backdating.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts?
Mean, My thoughts on this aren't very popular, so I'll get in trouble.
I could say them first if you want, because I've probably got similar views to you.
We're here to chat about you. You've asked me a question. I understand why people are doing it, and it for a long, when things really spiked value wise, it was a relatively inexpensive way to get a very cool looking car. I think if you haven't been around the early cars, the backdates are pretty cool. If you've been around the early cars a lot, they're a bit glaring because it's actually very hard to really disguise the origins of the car, particularly once you open a door. I think that there's been a bit of an overlooking of some of the other cool stuff you can do with a G-Series car or a 964. Outside of backdating. Mate of mine in Melbourne, Hugh Feggins, has got an awesome little G-Series hot rod. And it's just a cracking looking car. It's classic Guards red. It could not be more of what everyone thinks a 70s, 80s 911 should look like. But it's just got enough little touches and details that it doesn't look standard, but it doesn't look like it's trying to be sort of something it's not. And I think that and then you look into some of the stuff like the equivalent of like a 911 ST is probably like what they call an SCRS. And they were like the famous Bastos rally cars and stuff like that. They were cool. And the Group 4 cars, some people like them, some people don't. I just think that there is more there. As I mentioned off air, I've started to try and sort of find some of those. And so Rally Cab was one. I actually took delivery of one today. I've just come back with a car on the back of a trailer that's arrived from Adelaide, a Mega Mile 911 SC that hopefully, due to the fact that it hasn't done a million miles, it's done 750,000 kilometres. It's at 777 and change, and it's a little bit ratty around the edges. That to me is no holds barred. I can do whatever I want to that.
700. That's more than your average taxi. That's more than your average Falcon taxi in Sydney. Like, that's insane.
Yeah, I mean, it's a 1979 car.
How is it? Is it pretty shagged, cool, or is it pretty good?
It's pretty shagged. But it's dry. It's had, the engine's been done a few times. It started up, drove it onto the trailer. The carpet, I've never seen anything like it. The carpet is so compressed. It doesn't actually feel like carpet. Like, it feels like vinyl. It's no Concourse Queen. And I think that's a very difficult position people are in now. If you've gone and bought a really nice 3.2 Carrera, it has cost you, in relative terms, a lot of money. And so people, I think, are a bit reluctant to make either modifications that aren't reversible, or that they think might be altering their saleability chances. They're looking down the road a couple of years, might want to get something else. I get it. But I think I'm just a big fan of sort of personalization of cars, and part of it probably comes from the period where I got interested in cars and started reading a lot of car magazines and stuff like that was peak 80s madness. So you had like Gambala, Roof, Tekart, Slant Noses, all that kind of, which isn't seen very well now, but it was undeniable that it was cool.
It'll have its time.
If you tell someone that's how we'll look at singers in 5 years' time, they'll tip a drink on your head. they're somehow sacrosanct from all this. So
It's interesting, that attitude. I think it's you know, we've had Jordan Roddy on the podcast, and sort of Jordy has a lot of Japanese and Asian experience. And I think the difference, the attitude between West and East in terms of modifying cars, whereas in Japan, nobody thinks twice about doing whatever they want to a Ferrari, a Lamborghini. In fact, it's almost expected that you personalize it. Whereas over here, we sort of, you know, paint it the wrong color and everyone's up in arms. It's a bizarre cultural thing, I think, more than anything.
I think that's where, if Ryan can find those neglected high mile kind of cars, because there are they are out there.
You can use nugget.
You can find those nuggets.
Well, like, loved.
Like, you know, that's the perfect platform to do that kind of thing. And if you know, it needs a rebuild anyway, why not do it in the way that you want? I mean, I'm sure, Andrew, if X19 values ever get up there, you know, people come down on you for having a slightly different shade of green.
I welcome the day that I can fret about something like that, but it's a long way away, I think. But I guess this is a good segue that we've probably been dancing around for the last 10 minutes into Zollhaus, because what I was going to sort of say, and one thing I like so much about the Rally Cab and also about the Targa is that there's every modification, and I think it comes also to Felix's comment about the steering wheels, you know, and this is a good sort of, every modification is very carefully considered and thought out. And one thing I sort of struck me about the Rally Cab was there was nothing too radical on the car. There was not one thing that really was, it's not like you put an engine spoiler, you know what I mean? Like it was just a series of very carefully considered, relatively small modifications that add up to this yeah. That's greater than the whole.
Balanced modifications, balanced. You know, like nothing glaringly silly.
And I guess Zollhaus, you're probably a good way to...
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, without turning this into a giant plug fest, you know, that's...
Please do.
No, but that's a little kind of side business that I've been working on for a while, and it's about to sort of launch. I mean, you guys tipped me over the edge. I've actually finally launched like the Insta page and stuff like that, but it is going to be a couple of things. I will keep building stuff like this and finding cars because I enjoy it, and some of them I'll keep and some of them I'll sell, and so that will be one side of it. I'd also, you know, be more than happy to do that for others, whether they're, and I think there's a lot of people that are, you know, all the normal things that occur, people don't have it's interesting, like the purple car that's still up there, you know, that was finished just before the first Rennsport in Sydney, and it had a really, really interesting reaction. You know, most people, not all, most people really liked it. And most people, I think, were surprised that when you tell someone that you're going to paint your car purple and then give it a green interior, they kind of back away quietly.
I think I've got a picture of the interior too. The
interior is gorgeous.
But it took a huge amount of work to get everything right. From a sort of design sense, but you know, now it's loved, that car. I mean, people really, really respond to it. And I don't know, it's hopefully just you're kind of walking the walk a bit and saying, look, you can do stuff which is a bit interesting. It's not necessarily going to kill the value of your car. It can be fun. And I also like the whole, you know, the other sort of side of that little business will be more of an advisory thing, because, you know, I have done a whole bunch of this stuff. I've made all the mistakes. I kind of have a pretty good feel for what works. I have a pretty good feel for who things are. And I've sort of, I think there's a lot of people that want to do stuff with these cars, but they sort of don't know where to start. And I mean, we're talking about muscle cars. I'm now, hopefully, the proud owner of my first ever muscle car. And what has struck me about it is,
lost him.
I think we might have.
I've been researching them as an idea for a long time, but it can be a little bit daunting to sort of, and this is a very inexpensive car. You know, they're cheap and they're plentiful. And the parts for them are incredibly cheap. So you, you triple or double or quadruple that stress when you put it into an early 9/11, which might cost you 10 times as much to start with. And, you know, you do the wrong thing and suddenly you've got a, you know, like I said, these cars are incredibly robust. This, you know, engine rebuilds are still $30,000 and $40,000. You know, they're it can be very expensive very quickly. And even if you buy the wrong thing or
well, little things I found when I was helping you know, just with this 964 RS over here, and it's like I had no idea that the magnesium wheels were worth what they are worth. And you know, there's a lot of 964 RSs out there on replicas, and there's a couple that have their original wheels, and that's a big thing. Is it on its original wheels? Does it come with its original wheels? And that's something where if you were not intimately familiar with 964 RSs, it probably would be quite easy to buy a car, you know, and miss that crucial detail and then work out sort of, you know, a month down the track that you don't have the original wheels and they're impossible to find and, you know, get yourself in a bit of a hole that way. So, I mean, yeah, that, these cars are highly specialized and there's a lot to be aware of if you're not sort of really into it. So,
and so kind of, I mean, I've just referred back to the still not yet live website because I'm still building it and haven't.
Might need to get Ryan Mood to refresh. Ryan, are you there?
Yep.
Did you drop out just a couple of times?
Okay. It's fine from my end.
Okay, cool. All right.
Okay, keep going. Yeah, keep going. Let us know in the comments if anyone's having any sort of broadcast.
Just trying to look at that. I think a lot of people find themselves beholden to whatever workshop they've fallen in with, and there can be a conflict there. So looking at either the project management side of like restoration or a build for the current term, modifying, helping people source stuff, and cars that are right for modification are very different for ones that are right for restoration. They're very different again from investment cars. Design advice, modification advice, both kind of visual and sort of technical. Another one that pops up all the time is people that want to do historic motorsport. You've got to be really careful. You buy the wrong car or you make the wrong mod and you're just out. And people don't, I don't think a lot of people get really how subtle some of those things are. You often hear this, I'm building a race car. And you say, well, where are you going to race it? Oh, I'm going to do all this stuff. And you think, well, you're not going to do any of that stuff because you're building this thing without a clear plan. It's not going to get a historic logbook. You won't be able to tarmac rally it. Or if you do, you're going to be in a class with mega monsters getting your ass kicked. Yeah, and then, you know, research advice for provenance and things like that, historic rego, just kind of everything around that. I mean, the bit that I probably like the most is the more kind of custom builds, the sort of quirkier stuff. But the, you know, the investment side of it's interesting as well. That's, again, there's some subtleties in there that I think are pretty easy to miss and can make a, so I've got a, there'll be a couple of cars featured on the site. You know, I've got two cars that I just cannot, I just would not, from an investment viewpoint, modify. And, you know, and for very different reasons, you know, one's a very early Aussie 65, they're just too rare and it's a bit of a survivor, you know, it just deserves to be what it is. And I think the other car that you had a look at, the 964 Speedster, I mean, that was really interesting because that car just appeared out of the blue on car sales one day. and that's the 65. Yep. That's a beautiful little car.
That's beautiful.
It's like driving a big 356. The 964 Speedster was an interesting one because it was for sale by when the 997s came out. Some dude just walked into Porsche Centre Collingwood and said, I want a 997 coupe. And I said, have you got anything to trade? And he said, I've got this. He had a 32,000 kilometre 964 Speedster, one of six in the country. And they took it in trade and put it on car sales. And I don't think they really appreciated just how special it was. And it was priced for about what a good 964, I thought, for what about a good, you know, what does everyone want in a 964? They want a C2 coupe in a good color with low Ks, manual. And it was all that apart from the fact that it didn't have a roof. And the, you know, from an, you know, without talking about the grubby aspect of money, from an investment perspective, you know, that car now is an incredible buy. And again, getting that, having those cars kind of out there and being used again, people seeing them and sort of learning about them, there was a, it set off a little bit of a flurry. I mean, there's only six of these things in the country, three of them sold in quick succession. and yeah, they're lovely things to drive. They have a very, they don't drive like a normal 911. They feel like they've been put together with a bit of extra love and kisses.
So you don't not drive your cars purely from an investment point of view? Like if you've got this car, you're driving it?
Yes. I don't drive them a lot. I live in a city, so we're kind of pretty, you know, there's a lot of stuff to walk to, but you certainly improve them and keep them up, and you get to know what's going on if you do drive them. And it's just fun to get them out. I went on a very interesting little rally just before all the COVID lockdown stuff hit. We mentioned Royal Purple before. Some good friends in Sydney have got an original 27 RS that was delivered in Royal Purple but got restored into white like they all did through the 80s and 90s. And it was being taken back to be restored in Melbourne and it's going back to Royal Purple. And rather than just put on a transport and drive it there, they did a big phone around and they found a whole bunch of people. We all drove there. It was about 10 cars. And some of these cars were super, super, super rare and super valuable. Not all of them were, but there was things like 993 RSs, 964 RSs, modern stuff. I got lucky. I was co-pilot in the most comfortable seated car there, which was a 3.2 Carrera Club Sport. Again, they were so off the radar, those cars. No one knew about them. Lovely, lovely things. And that was a rip-roaring 2 days. Like that was, and then we all just turned around and drove back.
where did you drive? So that came from Sydney.
Went from Sydney and then sort of went.
Not down the Hume the whole way.
No. we took 2 days, went the long way, went sort of back roads and through. You know, it was kind of, it was also an interesting chance to sort of do a bit of post-bushfire kind of spread a bit of love that way. So we stayed in sort of, tried to stay in bushfire affected areas and just sort of, you know, see sort of firsthand what's going on. But it was, you know, all those cars were, you know, it was a pretty decent little rolling convoy of expensive cars and everyone was having a ball and everyone was swapping and you drive this and I'll drive that.
Awesome.
Very
cool.
So I think, but you know, something like a Speedster or something, you know, I wouldn't leave it in a shopping centre car park, but it's, you know, it's also, we've done a few little just kind of fun rallies with mates and stuff. We're just, you know, doing an overnighter somewhere. You know, if you're going to do that and you're going to have fun and you have a fang, your car will get stone chipped. I mean, it's just what happens. I don't get too hung up about stuff like that. I don't do very well with concoursey perfect cars because of that reason. I find it a bit stressful. And I'm not a detailer. I hate detailing with a passion. I hate washing cars with a passion, actually. And I think you just end up sort of trying to surround yourself with like-minded people that have a similar, you know, and I think that's one of the interesting things about the rise and rise and rise of sort of cars and coffee type events. You know, often it's not much, but at least it's getting stuff out and warm and seen, and you can fit it into the other demands of your life, you know, young children, family, work, and just, I think all that kind of stuff is fun. And people get to, and the rarer stuff gets, I think it's more, it's just a great thing to have it out there. So something like you just don't see speedsters. There's just none, frankly. And they're just cool. They're just a really interesting thing. And you sort of take experiences from these things. What I really like about the speedster is, despite the fact that I'm was a wranger and fair, and now I'm bald, I'm not your typical convertible driver. I didn't really think about convertibles. And I bought that car. The fact it was a convertible was quite irrelevant. I bought it because it was a speedster and because I thought it was cool and it was rare. And I liked the white on white on white color scheme, and everything about it ticked all the boxes. And I thought it was going to be something resembling a decent investment at some point. But it sort of opened my eyes to open top cars, which a lot of people sort of say that they will never have a convertible because they're terrible, and yet they've never really driven one. And they're in the right context, they're super cool. I think what gets interesting is there can be a hierarchy too. I mean, if you had to have a 911, it's probably always going to be a sunroof coupe.
Yeah.
That is, I think, one of the best car photographs.
That photo is spectacular.
That's a Thomas
Walk. Is that the Thomas Walk? Yeah,
it's Thomas Walk.
That is.
Who knew Macquarie Centre shopping car park was so glamorous?
In fact, I actually got the Type 7 book here. Yeah. If I flick through, if I'm not mistaken, your speedster is in this book, isn't it?
Yeah, we did a little fun thing. We tried to sort of do a compare and contrast as to why you would have something like that, super interesting, super rare, manual, stripped out, blah, blah, blah. And at the time, my daily driver was a 964 Tiptronic, which, of course, is the devil's spawn.
Nobody wants them.
And the dad rod, wasn't it?
Dad rod.
yeah.
Which was hilariously fun. Like, that was another little, for want of a better description, another design project. These cars are robust enough that you can use them as proper daily drivers.
Mm.
You can put your kids in them. That car had a roof rack. We had all kinds of shit on it. We went camping in it. And the reason it was a Tiptronic, again, it was close to half the value of a comparable manual, and you couldn't modify a comparable manual for fear of interrupting its kind of investment potential. And sometimes you just want to go and drive, and Tiptronics, in their own way and in the right context, are actually fun. And I coming out of that late 80s, early 90s, I've got a fascination with color-matched wheels.
Oh, that was the best thing about that car.
And it was really, so when I sold it, I had to take all that stuff off. In terms of a project to build and then move on and do something else, it was a disaster. No one wanted it.
I was actually going to ask that question. That was something that was coming to my mind as we're talking about Zollhaus and projects and the number of sheer volume of cars that you've owned and the number that you've also done work to. Was there any that were like difficult to sell or no one had any interest or kind of got your brand,
Rob,
if will?
The dad rod was interesting. I live in a city, Sydney, and it was photographed relentlessly. It was hilarious how often it got photographed on Instagram and all that kind of stuff, and it was huge fun. But when I went to sell it, I initially advertised it in that form with a pretty tongue-in-cheek ad and just got crickets. And so, and part of that was sometimes you do have to keep things reversible. So I reversed it all, which took all of an afternoon. And then it sold pretty quickly after that. And it's currently in a shipping container on its way to LA to be transformed into a Singer.
Wow.
So full circle.
And it was interesting. I think And the guy that bought it wasn't looking for one because he'd assumed, like everyone else, that you have to give Singer a manual.
Yeah, but
they all get converted to 6-speed, so yeah, they're quite happy to take a tip. The tips have all had very easy lives.
So for those, just quickly, perfect. with the Type 7 book, page 90, that is the Speedster. Behold that up there. Beautiful photograph. Thomas's photo is just spectacular, absolutely spectacular. But yeah, very cool.
Yeah, so off to Singer. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I got to know this fellow quite well. So this car will return as the Bondi Commission.
It's coming back to Australia.
Yeah. No, it's cool. It'll be the fifth. Cool. It's the fifth Australian order. And I'm actually giving him some, just a little bit of advice on how to spec it, and sort of probably. Some of the more historical kind of context, like I won't reveal what color he's chosen, but he's chosen sort of a fairly classic Porsche color, and trying to help him, get the right kind of, interior and sort of, you've got a pretty big palette with those guys.
I was about to say, is there a limit?
Not really. Which I think is a bit of a shame now, because the early ones were pretty highly influenced by the founder, Dickinson, who is an early 911 aficionado. And they all had, I thought they all had sort of pretty good styling cues from that period of cars. I think now they'll build whatever you want. They're looking, some of the ones that are out recently, I think, look shocking.
You can go too far.
Yeah, well, they're not too far away from Diamantes on the roof lining. I think some of them are looking pretty glitzy.
Yeah. Ryan, can I ask you a question? And this, if you either don't know the answer or don't want to reveal the answer, please feel free to decline the question. If you export a Tiptronic 964 to America, which is worth X, and then you bring back into the country a Singer, which is worth Y, what are the tax implications in terms of import duties? Are you just having some work carried out and you can get it back in without having to pay like luxury car tax and all of those duties?
No, this was a big bugbear. So this is why you've got Singers in New Zealand and not in Australia. So it was unclear for a long time. And the big thing at the moment, which is really affecting bringing cars into Australia, is luxury car tax. So it kicks in at about 70 grand, and I haven't checked it for a while, but it's 35, 40 cents in the dollar. So it's huge. So it skews our market terribly for anything which is, say a car that's probably 120, 150 grand Aussie and up. You just can't compare them with cars overseas because you're going to have this massive LCT component. And what a lot of the Australian pricing is based on, you'll see a car in the UK, for example, it's right-hand drive, it's ready, and it'll be terrifically cheaper than what they are here. And people are going, well, yeah, but by the time you get it here and you pay LCT. So Singer had that issue. So there was a cloud. There was a couple of things. And this is all, I've just picked this up all third hand. But what I understand was happening was there was a risk it was going to be deemed a new car. And so in that case, there was a risk you couldn't bring it back at all. Or you could bring it back, and you had to somehow put it through ADR, or you could bring it back and you then invoke luxury car tax. They managed to get one of the first one or two customers, and again, this is, don't quote me on any of this, but this is just my understanding of it, is they have an LCT ruling from the Australian Tax Office, which says that the car is being restored. And so now LCT doesn't apply, the car can come back in. There's been an existing system for years for competition cars called a Carnet or a Carnet, Carnet, which allows you to take a car overseas for an event and bring it back in without duty. And I believe that the cars are going in and out on a Carnet.
On a Carnet.
And coming in without LCT. Yeah. So you'd be, it should just be shipping, which in the context of a Singer is nothing. And and GST on the restoration cost.
So you still have to pay Australian GST on a restoration cost carried out in California. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful?
that's my understanding, yeah.
Yeah.
But they, fantastic. I don't know when the first one's due to hit here, but it can't be far away.
Fantastic.
Because, again, the last time I looked, some of the carnets have a pretty limited life on them. Like, they might be 12 months or something. Yeah. You know, they're not an indefinite. You know, you don't get to send this thing overseas indefinitely. Mm. We'll start seeing them in decent number, I think. I know there's at least five. Interesting process. There's like an 18-page QA document you have to get through. You have to measure the car because they're not in the business of restoring cars. They don't want anything which is bent or that's ever been damaged or that needs any classic restoration work. They just want to do their thing. I've heard of cars getting rejected that have got there.
Can you send them a shell or do you have to send them a car?
They greatly prefer you to send them a car. They prefer it to be matching numbers if possible. It doesn't have to be, but I know that some countries for older cars have unusual rules around things not being matching numbers. So I think it makes it easier. It was interesting, that little red car there. Look, it was a Guards Red Tiptronic. It was pretty unloved. It was fun. It was actually a really, really, really clean car. And I must admit, I had it at home after it was sold. And every time I'd walk past it, and you kind of think so much of this is either going in the bin or going to a wrecker's. It made me feel a bit odd about, look, when I see it as a singer, I'll probably think it's pretty cool. But my understanding is that they do have almost a job lot arrangement with a dismantler, a local dismantler. So the cars, it's not going in the bin. You know, I think if you were trying to find like a rear speaker grill for a 964 at the moment in the States, it'd be very easy. there'd be piles of hundreds of them. But it did.
964 standard suspension. Easy.
But it did give me pause for thought that, it's
one day maybe we'll be wondering.
It just struck me that it was a it sort of circles back to what we were talking about before. When we touched on this, off air, the kind of what's okay to modify and what's not, and it really does depend on context. I think I know when Group S Historic Racing changed its rules, and it used to cut off at I've forgotten the exact year. It used to cut off at about 72 or 73. When they broadened it out, suddenly all the 2.7 MFI Carreras were the hot ticket. I mean, it became very clear very quickly that if you wanted to win Group S, you had one of those. And so a lot of guys that were very experienced racers from old Porsche Cup days and stuff like that started buying them and converting them into race cars. And generally they tried to find one that was a bit down at heel because, it was going to get pretty comprehensively, modified and roll cages and a lot of nothing's irreversible, like that, one of the ones that got converted into a race car was an absolute minter concourse car. And a lot of people were sort of a bit kind of cross about it. And I just kind of thought the guy that was doing that was a very, 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 very well-known racer. He'd prepped cars before, and I think it was just purely efficiency. Rather than spend, 9 months getting a rusty Hulk back to some semblance of a car again. Why don't you just start with a good one and it can all be reversed? And, but I think that was at that time a fairly kind of novel approach. I saw a similar thing. One of the guys we used to tarmac rally a 964 RS again before they were worth what they were now.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing this car, it arrived from New Zealand, it was really mint. and it was being prepped at the workshop, Michael Newton Automotive, that looks after my rally car. And I mean, it looked like it just needed the stickers put on. And I've turned up 2 weeks later and it is a bare shell. Everything is off. Everything is being rebuilt. And I was just like, what is going on? I thought that car was a minter. And he's like, yeah, but it's a competition car. So this is how we prepare competition cars for this guy. And it was the correct thing to do, because a lot of other people, I think, would have done the bare minimum. And then their first three or four rallies would have been a series of failures and things that didn't quite work. Whereas this thing was just a weapon out of the box from day one. It probably showed a maturity in the owner, probably reflected in the means available to the owner. But it certainly, it was an eye-opener for someone like me to, I had started with a very basic package car that had sort of evolved over time. This was, I want to be here. And I'm just going to go straight there. And knowing what I know now, I think it is a more efficient avenue if the means are there to do it.
There's definitely that serious motorsport approach to things, that you're right, you know, fix the problems before they happen. And then you'll go and, as you said, do 3-4 events and have no mechanical retirements, no failures. You know what you've got. You can maintain the car at that level. You're not sort of fixing old problems. Well, and
this is an interesting discussion I have with people a lot when helping people buy like air-cooled cars, and you see X-track cars or X-rally cars or X-group S cars, things like that come up, and my advice is generally these things are going to be probably better maintained than most road cars, because I can tell you, if you're going to Target Tasmania and you've got a notchy second gear, well, your gearbox is coming out before you go and it's getting done. Whereas if you're going to Cars and Coffee and running to the shops, you'll live with a notchy second gear for 2 years.
That was always, even at a very much lower level, that was always my dad's argument. We had our Alfa Romeo that we, you know, did track days and sprints with, and he was, you know, the police were always, you know, that thing about modified cars, and there were a few things on it that weren't quite legal. And he was sort of saying, like, what car has a complete spanner check every time it's driven? Like, every suspension bolt on it has a spanner check. Like, most people haven't seen underneath their car for 4 years, and it'll get an oil change if it's lucky. Like, what's safer in that? Like, what's a better way of approaching the maintenance of a car than a competition mindset? Like, it's definitely.
And they get driven harder, but they do get, my experience is, they get service, you know, way more regularly, and some of the cars which are sort of like 3-liter Carreras in the Porsche world are a great example. They were a good rally car. They fit class as well. You could run them in Group S. They're a good Group S. In fact, they've really emerged now as the engine builders have got to work out how to deal with CIS. They've really emerged as front running cars. But one of those, as a X sort of Group S car, they're not that hard to make them a nice road car again. You know, they generally don't have crazy suspension because you're not allowed to do that. Yeah, you've got to take roll cages out and put seats back in and trim and stuff. But, you know, I've tipped a couple of people into those and they've been really happy. They would have just been passed by. That's a track car. Can't go there.
Also, the problem are a lot of bargains. I mean, you see in the auctions over here, some absolute bargains come up, and you're talking a lot of, you know, the RS and the RSR builds, you know, your 74, 75 RSR builds that have just had £150,000 thrown at them, and they're just this amazing car, and they go through the auctions at 30, 40, 50 grand because, you know, no one wants them, yet people will pay an extra third for an original but completely worn out sort of Carrera that needs everything. And you go, what's a better car to enjoy? I don't know. So I guess we would be remiss if we didn't probably need to wrap this the podcast up shortly, but we would be remiss if we didn't ask you about the black car that is also in your collection, which is nothing to do with Porsche, touches on the Italian thing, as we mentioned earlier.
I'll backtrack. So the muscle car is, I don't know. I've I've had lots of different 911s, and they're my core favorite car, you know, and that's where my knowledge base is, and I just have a real love for them. Growing up in Geraldton, it was all like, you know, HQs and Tunners and, you know, UC Taranas, you know, which are now, oddly enough, all also incredibly valuable.
Unbelievably, yeah.
But the Muscar thing is an itch I'm scratching at the moment. I just thought it's the kind of thing that if I don't do it in the next few years, I'm just never get around to doing it and I'll regret it. Mm-hmm. And they're relatively inexpensive and they're, so there is hopefully somewhere between Iowa and here, a 1971 Plymouth Roadrunner with a pistol grip 4-speed, which is pretty cool.
Yes.
In Hemi orange. But the big car, so I got a call from a fellow I know who used to work for one of the independent Porsche shops, and also he was a trained Ferrari mechanic. He used to moonlight a bit at one of the Ferrari shops, and he rang me up one day, and he knows I like things that are odd colours, and said, "We're helping a guy sell a car. You should come and have a look." And I said, "What is it?" And he said, "It's a 308 Ferrari." And I said, "I don't want a 308 Ferrari. He said, you should come and have a look." And I've just got images of Magnum PI and all the rest of it.
Ready to shave off the beard and get a mow.
So I get up there, and this thing is a bit down at heel and it needs a bit of love, but it is the only metallic gold 308 that ever came to Australia, and it's never been painted red. And so this guy is fielding calls from people who are telling him how they're going to paint it red and ripping out the original chalky brown interior and make it tan to look like Magnum's car, and he's literally slamming the phone down. And it was right. This
good on him. Yeah, good on him to do that.
So working with those guys, took that on.
I was there when you picked it up.
You were there when I picked it up.
Beautiful car, beautiful thing. Yeah.
Got it all sorted. And I was really, really surprised how much I enjoyed it, how much I enjoyed its differences. It's very, very different from an air-cooled 911. And it kind of opened my eyes a bit to Italian cars. And I'm sort of a bit of a self-confessed design geek. And I ended up selling that car for about a year and a half. And I sold it. It sold well. I'm in love with Italian cars now. I've had one. It's never broken down, and I've just sold it for more than I paid for it. You know, the world's a beautiful place.
Yeah,
and
as good as it gets.
but the biggie in terms of design impact. I think the Lambo Countach is the. It's had more design impact on the car world than any other car. I don't think it's the prettiest car ever made. I don't think it's the best car ever made. But I think in the sports car realm, it's got an undeniable impact. They only made 2,000. Everyone knows what they are. Everyone's got a context for them, whether it's something as dinky as Cannonball Run or just a vague 80s kind of association. But they are... I think they're an extraordinary piece of design. They're hard to find. There's not many around. They're incredibly difficult to value, blah, 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 blah. You know, long story short, found a good one in good old Adelaide. And there's never really a sensible time to buy something like that, but it was possible. I'd been restoring a proper literal far north Queensland barn find. I'd found a 1967 Aussie delivered 911 in a colour called beige grey, which I think it was the only one. I was midway through that. I was getting a bit worn down by it. It wasn't going as well as I'd hoped. It was going slower. It was getting a bit to be a drag. So the gold Ferrari went, that got packaged up, sold something else as well, sold, you know. And I'm now the proud owner of a 5,000 QV Countach, full fat, what is now known as a downdraft. Mm-hmm. So, or I was pretty ambivalent. I just wanted a flared contouche.
Contouche, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't really care high body, low body, power, 4,000, 5,000. I just wanted, if I could have had my dream spec, it would have been white on white. I think that would have been full Miami. This one's black on black. The spec is pretty important. The contouches have sort of four series. The Periscopio cars, Periscopio, are in a league of their own. They're the first gen. They'll always be the first gen.
Yeah.
Then there's sort of the middle cars. The 25th anniversary cars are not really, they're just not as highly sought after. And there's a lot of them.
They're the least prettiest one as well.
They're the least prettiest.
They just went a bit far with it.
Yeah, I mean, when Pagani started releasing cars, they started to get a bit of, he was the stylist.
He
modded it. And that gave them a bit of sort of cred for a while. But I think a lot of people think that the big air boxes on the haunches are a big part of the Countach thing. I looked at a few of them. And I thought, I'm always going to sit there and stare at that car in the garage and think, gee, I could have tried a bit harder. and so probably the second most desirable spec coming out now is what they call a downdraft. So quad valve, all the power, six Webers, sounds beautiful. Everyone thinks it's terrible to drive. It's actually very lovely to drive. From a control perspective, they're a really lovely thing. You know, I had a pretty mean 930 back in the day. It had a far heavier clutch than the Lambo does. Again, not a car you take to the shops. It's not a car that I ever try and reverse if I can really.
Does the sitting on the sill work? Is that how you do it?
Does.
If you have to?
Yeah, no, it does. It actually does work. The vision out of them. I'm going to do some mods to the seat on mine because I just fundamentally don't fit. And I can drive it, but I'm in a really compromised position, and it doesn't help the vision. Yeah. And look, the vision out the back is terrible. The vision out the front is okay, but there is just nothing like them. they're a funny thing. They attract a lot of attention. Most of it's good, some of it's not. And it's taken me a while to get used to the attention that they attract because, you can drive around in I drive around in a bright purple 911 and people go, that's cute. And then, whatever. You roll past in a black Countach and people are like, holy hell, what's this guy doing? I don't know. I just try and kind of use it. I don't use it a lot, but I certainly use it. You know, in a cars and coffee context, I sometimes feel it can be a bit dominating, and I don't like. I don't ever want it to be. Sort of taking attention away from other cars that I think are just as interesting or that have had more, or just the same amount of love or work or whatever. And it was fascinating the last time I took it out. There's a little local cars and coffee near me in Centennial Park every month. And some guys are following me in probably the nicest Datsun 1200 you've ever seen in your entire life. This thing was beautiful. And it turns out the guy driving it, we've got a common friend. He jumps out. We're having a bit of a chat. And look, there was a buzz around the Countach. There always is. That's cool. Can I sit in it? Yeah, whatever. I try to be, fairly generous. Because a lot of people, myself included, never seen one really, or sat in one or heard one fire up or whatever.
No.
But at one point, and it was really the high point of the morning, the guy opened the bonnet of the Datto. He was showing someone, and his engine bay was ridiculous. Like, it was just perfect. And a fellow walked past, and at this point, there was about seven people trying to look at the same time into a very small engine bay of about 1200. And this guy's just come past and quite rightly said, you know you're at a car meet when there's seven people staring into the engine bay of Datto 1200, ignoring the Countach, which is 3 feet away, like parked in front of him.
Including the owner of the Countach.
And that was a really, really nice moment.
Yeah.
That's sort of when you have one of those, you know, car people are all right. You know, it's because it is interesting and it's rare and they are they are a pretty amazing thing. And they're quite different in the flesh to the photos. They're actually quite curvy. Like people think they're a very straight line car. They're actually quite not.
Mm-hmm.
It felt that morning, it was like this was the right decision to bring this car out. There wasn't 27 Aventadors. It wasn't a big dick swinging contest. It was a pretty low key event. And this kind of interaction with the Datto guy, and my first car was a Datto. It was sort of the icing on the cake. It was really nice.
Yeah.
I walk past it every once in a while and sort of catch eye of it. And it's like a real pinch yourself moment. It's like, whoa, fuck, it's a Countach in there.
you seen this? Because it's funny. One of your actual car is one of my earliest automotive childhood memories, because when I was in primary school in Mount Barker, South Australia, you know, country town, not quite as remote as Geraldton, but you know, you didn't see that stuff all the time.
Still the same quantity of like HQ one times and stuff.
HQ
like that.
One times and that sort of stuff. And that car belonged to, it wasn't my school, but there were three high schools, but it was one of the other schools in town, and it was not too far away. And I remember that the kid's dad had your car. I'm pretty sure it was your car, and he would pick his son up from school, and it was a last day of term treat. Not all the time, it was just a last day of term treat. And I remember walking home from school on the Friday, you know, that last day of term kind of holiday feeling. And I saw that go past, and sometimes he would come in the other one and sometimes it was the black one, but you pretty much count that last Friday you'd see one of the Lamborghinis.
Yeah.
And I remember Druids Avenue, Mount Barker, walking home, and this black Countach goes past just idling at like 20 k's an hour. All the kids just slack jawed, just, you know, because we'd never seen anything like that in Mount Barker, and that has been seared into my memory. And it's pretty weird that you've ended up with that same car. Like, it's, and I guess that's the impact they have on people. You remember the first time you saw one, like
they have that presence. That they're such a presence.
I looked at one beforehand. Good old Gosford Classic Car Museum had a couple at one point before they turned out to not be a museum. and they had
one of the red ones, didn't they?
Yeah, well, and one of the red ones they had was the Modern Motor cover car, which was quite a well-known car because it was delivered with colour-matched wheels, which is a particular quirk of mine. And I have one of those moments. I'm sitting there, in the documentation that came with the car was a copy of May 1985, whatever, Modern Motor, with this red Countach on the cover with the huge red mags. Yeah. Sadly, some idiot painted them silver. And I was just like, wow, this is the car that I read the road test of 30 odd years ago. I've just sat in it. I've just fired it up. I actually even made an offer on it, and then they politely told me to, you know, thank you. That offer wasn't quite good enough.
Needed extra zero.
It was pretty interesting, and I think it also comes down to the fact that I don't know how many are here. I guess it'd be 20 to 30, but they're not seen very often, sadly. A lot of them, you know, a lot of them are in barely running condition just because they've set up for too long. I looked at another one in a deceased estate that hadn't run for 25 years. You know,
that needs everything. That's everything.
That needs absolutely everything. You know, there was no bit of mystery oil down the cylinders for that one. I mean, it was, and it was a, yeah, it really, really, it was one of the original motor show cars. Like, it had everything going for it, apart from the fact that, I mean, everything in this was a big, big deceased estate sale. And there was, I don't know, 30 or 40 cars, but they'd all been sitting since the 90s, basically.
Yeah. And that's the thing with those cars is that they run best when they're used and used regularly and used hard. Like, that's one, you know, that's well, they, the best they one, fall the high my, mileage ones.
They fall into my cars that have water in them, you know, which I tend to try and avoid. So I now have a car that has water.
A lot of water.
A lot of water.
But it's, I've done a little bit of work to that car. It had this like hectic 90s sound system in it, which has since been removed, and it's now got the little 9-jewel Alpine. And including it had these funny ignition leads with like they're like a little filter that stops engine noise getting through your hi-fi. And the car was running terribly, and we took those off and put standard plugs back in it and standard leads, and it's a different car. It's wonderful. Starts first turn of the key. It's really, really cool. They're quite like I said, there's no easy way to justify something like that. But I don't know how. I don't really have a fixed time frame in mind for that car. But it's certainly, you know, what's the tattoo say? No regrets, you know. It's, it's pretty cool. It's
I bet your kids think you're the coolest dad in the world. So that alone must justify it.
Did any kid think their dad's cool?
No, I'm not cool to my kids. You know that I've taken them out in every car I've ever had, and tell you what they do. It's very interesting. They do react. They really like the purple Targa. They like the roof off. It's noisy. It's loud. It's low.
And men of taste.
The but everything else is just an old uncomfortable car that I've shoveled them into the back of. they know that the Countach is. I think even at 6 and 10, the Lamborghini brand is what it is. Yeah. They know that it's something kind of special, but they don't. You know, they're down in the garage bouncing basketballs off them when they miss a hoop. You know, so it's it's just what it is. You know.
Yeah. Anyway, Ryan, thank you. If we've got anything else,
my pleasure.
We're pushing sort of, you know, nearly to getting up to 2 hours, so we probably should.
You find the steering wheel for the rally cab while we're on it?
Yes, the Omo Sistema.
The Sistema, the world's most 80s steering wheel.
So 80s.
And the weird thing is, I actually I pestered the new owner for about 6 months, and I eventually got it back because I couldn't find another one. So I found him this minter, like special edition prototipo, blah blah blah. I don't know what it was, and I put it in the mail and mailed it to him. And he mailed me back my beloved Sistema, which I had on the 964 for a while, and then that then graduated to the good old Benetton quad color 90 special. Which I must admit, that's not going to Singer. I kept that. I put the standard wheel back on when I saw it. Very hard to find a car that can actually support such a wheel. But yeah,
you almost have to buy the car for that wheel.
I think part of that's it's an interesting little subtopic is that again in the early 911 context, like the 65, 64 to 73 cars, this kind of modification thing emerged, and there was a couple of little clubs in the US. One was called R Group, and they started getting really cookie cutter. I thought they, pardon the pun on the wheels. There was this kind of list of acceptable things you could do.
They actually had a list, didn't they? They literally had a list.
Yeah, there was what they call the sports purpose book, and it got yeah, it got sort of a bit weird. Like it was, you know, and so suddenly every one of these cars had a bloody prototipo. Look, they're a lovely steering wheel, don't get me wrong. They're, you know, but wow. use anything else, use something else. Yeah, I don't know. That's sort of something that I've always tried to keep in mind. So, you know, I don't and I've now ended up with a kind of a no prototipo rule. I'll kind of run anything else. But so that probably puts me in the same camp as all the other guys that are, I don't know. but I think it is interesting how and look, you see it in other marks. You see it in JDM cars. You know, there's just a few things that become almost, you know, like the Japanese train grab rails as tow hooks, you know, and I get that now. That's just a nod. That's just a nod to the old country. I think that's pretty cool. But
yeah. I hate them. Like, I hate them with a passion. It doesn't serve a, like, yeah, it's a tow hook, but are you really going to tow your car with it?
Yeah, probably not.
No. But I get what you mean. It's like if you have a Bayside Blue R34 GTR, you put bronze T37s on it and you put XYZ and it becomes the same modified car, which is cool. They look gorgeous, but I get these things are trying to do something different. Like.
And it's, but I think with that early 911 thing, and I suspect it was driven in part by value concerns and by sort of just people being a bit conservative. I want to do this, but I don't want to go too far. But it just meant that a lot of other cool stuff, I think, got sort of pushed to the side. And when you see one of those cars done well with a bit of flair, they're an amazing, amazing platform. And I think they're... And I think the G, you know, we're getting back to the beginning, I think the G series cars are the same. So, I mean, one thing that I've always tried to do is if you see a cool oddball seat or like a Sistema or just something that you think that's pretty rad, you know, we'll just stash it away and just kind of you might have a use for it. I bought something ridiculous on eBay about a week ago. They've just arrived, which is a Guagaro branded set of fog lights that have like little flip ups, like flip up glasses, like mounted onto the front of them. And they've got like they're square with like a pinstripe and Guagaro's signature. They're on eBay for like $100, so they're not a high dollar item. I don't know where they came from.
Gorgeous.
I know they're not gorgeous. They're pretty awesome.
But, I mean, it's so bad it's good. Like gorgeous.
they're just something a bit different, and they're kind of interesting. Just a bit of fun.
Yeah,
and I think you know, you can there are things. There's other seat brands other than Recaro that are cool, you know, but in early Porsche terms, if you don't put in a sports Recaro, you're somehow missing out. And it's like, well, there's all kinds of stuff. A friend of mine's doing an early 911 little hot rod at the moment, and it's looking like it's going to get 1750 GTV seats, and they look mint in there.
They are gorgeous.
With the wing ones with the hoop.
Trimmed in Porsche materials. They're the right size, and everyone's just going to be standing in this car going, what are these seats? They're so cool.
And the value on those seats are going to go up even more again. I think I saw like a shell of one of those for sale for like $2,000 for a single seat.
I mean, like the sports seats that come in mid-year, you know, in early 911s, you know, have been 10, 15, like just insanity levels of price. And then that kind of fuels the replica market. So then, that almost makes it worse. It's good because it brings it down to a base where it's more affordable, but then you just suddenly see, everyone's got the fakies in I think can get around it without spending a lot of money, just with a bit of creativity and a bit of design, I think.
I think even on the car front, like I think a lot of people in a whole range of subjects do sort of confuse value and coolness. Like just because something's expensive doesn't make it cool, and just because it's not expensive doesn't make it uncool. And, you know, in the automotive world, there are so many great bargains out there and so many fun platforms and fun cars that you can do really cool stuff with and have build something that you can park alongside one of your 911s and be exactly proud of it. That is
worth absolutely
a fifth of the price, you know. And
but I think I've had
a couple of mates into cars recently that just basically wanted something cool and set very firm, you know, pretty modest budgets, but with a pretty open sort of slather as to the actual car. And they're having a great time. They're not, you know, they're buying these depreciation proof assets. Yeah, they take more upkeep, but they're fun. And it's a genuine, as a second car or a fun car or a weekend car, I think it's a genuine option to having another new car in the garage. I've just helped a friend of mine buy an E30 Cabriolet. It's, you know, 11 grand for a really nice one. It had the BBS alloys, it had the Recaro sports seats as factory. It was really nicely spec'd. And it's just cool. Like he loves driving it, loves the fact it's a manual, you know.
Where would you put 10 grand for a fun sort of cool weekend cars and coffee belting around kind of fun car?
I like some of the old Mercs, but they can be a bit kind of doughy. I think some of the interesting Japanese stuff is pretty cool. I saw a little, I don't know what it was. I should have taken a photo of it. It was like a little 90s two-door Honda, but it was like a camback wagon. Just at my local mechanics across the road the other day. And I just kind of thought that with a set of, like, pucker little Japanese wheels. But I think that gets you some pretty cool BMWs. Probably doesn't get you much of an Alfa these days. Although I must admit I've got a soft spot for SUDs, probably because they were released about the time I started reading magazines. You just got to find the one in the world that isn't full of rust. I'm sure there's one out there. I think... I'm actually doing this exercise for a friend at the moment who's got two kids in the same age as mine, and we found we're going to try and look at it hopefully next weekend. Probably was a Honda Accord Aero Deck. Thank you. like a 528, like a shark nose 528 four door. In a manual,
yeah.
I kind of thought what that would be, just a really tight little fun. It's a good size, it's a four door manual box, straight six. It was a wee bit out of the budget, but not out of sort of negotiating range, but stuff like that. But I think, there's what is interesting at the moment is, like anything with chrome bumpers is being sought after by everyone. So like my first car, Datto 1600, you know, if you can find one, and if you wanted one that was, say, still with an L series engine and wasn't, you know, too highly modified, I mean, that's a $20,000 to $30,000 proposition now. I mean, that's just crazy. I mean, I, you know,
240 Zs as well. I remember those
240 Zs.
240 Zs. When I bought my X19, they were more. They were about double, but they were still comfortably sub five. You know, this is a long time ago now. But even 10 years ago, they were, you know, 10 to 15 sort of range. But now they're, you know, double that again.
Like back in high school, the crew that I used to hang with. I had my 124cc. Another mate had a 260Z, and then another mate had a Mustang 2+2. And, you know, like, you think about high school kids having, you know, something similar to that now, and
I think the other thing that's interesting is the kind of I saw something the other day. Got a mate who's got a really beautiful Julia, beautiful Julia, you know, and when you really stop and look at one of those for a long time, you think, this is actually it's kind of a frumpy four-door, but it's really beautiful in its own way and makes all the right noises.
That's actually that's the car that got my dad into Alphas back in the day.
But the generation that came after that, where they sort of squared them up a bit, I don't know enough about Alphas to know what that is.
It's a Berliner.
Yeah,
2000 Berliner,
2000 Berliner or 1750 Berliner, or, you know.
You look at those, they're 20% the price. Like, they're, I don't know what they are. They're very, very cheap.
Oh, yeah, cheap.
I understand that they're a much better car, that they're a better car. Like, they're more comfortable, they're faster, they handle better than the Julias.
But if you got one of those, and I was actually talking about this with someone, you know, so you get one of those, you lower it a bit, you put some cool wheels on it, you pull the bumpers off, maybe some fog lights, just some sort of pretty typical Julia-esque type things.
Mm.
I think you've got a really cool little, sedan. For very, very, very little dough, that, you know, is just kind of one generation away. What else is out there? I mean, I think the other thing that I keep seeing, and again, I think it just comes back to sort of age, the kind of early 90s Mercs, for some reason, like the big two-door Mercs are pretty cool. I saw something the other day. It actually was a big red two-door Merc. It had red color-coded wheels. Normally they have they have sort of gray spoilers. It's all been done cheesy as hell, but you're kind of picking that. I've watched it in the 911 world. Early 911s went push, so everyone went, okay, if I can't have one of those, I'll go and buy an SC or a 3.2. Bang. You know, 964s had a bit of the Singer effect, but I think 964s, people realize just how, there's not very many of them, and how robust they are. I mean, talk about a car you can use as a daily driver. I mean, holy hell, they're just so easy to live with. The aircon works, they've got ABS, blah, blah, blah. But like, you know, 944s are having a run now. Poor old 928s. I once found a 928 walking my dog, which I eventually bought for $5,000. That's time story for another time. But I think a lot of that stuff, again, I keep coming back to this concept of design. I think if you have a really good overall picture in your mind of where you want to end up, you can make, not quite make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, but in the JDM world, I think it's really interesting because I think the breadth of cars is a lot broader, and you see people doing interesting, sometimes wacky stuff on really unsuspecting platforms, and it's really cool. There's a question, is it too late to find a good 944 turbo at a reasonable price? Gee, I wouldn't hang around for long. Yeah, I think it probably is. 944 turbos are fascinating. I think the one thing that everyone's finally realised is they're actually fast.
Very fast. Think,
oh, they're this, they're that, and, you know.
They're the kind of having tarmac rallying now.
Yeah, I mean, I think they make a terrible noise when they start. It's always turned me off. I just can't handle the noise when they start. But they are properly fast, and you can make them. There's a shop here that specializes in transaxles, Buchanans, and holy hell, those guys are building weapons out of them. Like, like proper 500 and 600 horsepower sleepers out of them. Like they're hilarious. Yeah.
Well, with the age of where we're at with computer management and turbos, it's just changed the game with those cars.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, in the Porsche world, the 914s are a difficult proposition here. They're very cool, but there's very few. I don't think there's a lot of good ones. And you've either got to be comfortable in a left hook car, or you've got to find one that's been converted well. A lot of them have been converted from 4 to 6. I think you've really got to know your shit to get one. I think otherwise you could end up with a pup pretty kind of easily. Good old 924 turbos are pretty cool if you get one in the right color. Stuff like that. The 968 Club Sports are sublime on the road. I mean, they just are ridiculous how composed and how much grip they've got.